Father, we thank you for your love and your sweetness to us, and your constant goodness, and the quietness, and your gentleness, and your presence in our life. And we would just ask that it would be here, and we would be aware of it today. And that your Spirit would lift up your Son in our eyes as we look at the events of those last couple of days and toward the cross. And over the Passion season, that you would honor your Son before us, Lord. We know you love him, and you sent the Spirit to honor him and teach us these things, and we would ask that we would fall in step with your good heart tonight. Bless these minutes that we spend together. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, we are, at this point, we are on page 25, which corresponds roughly to Thursday night, probably right after the Passover meal. So he's had the Passover, institution of the Last Supper, and what was a pre-Passover Passover meal. We talked about that. Okay, and they've done the cup, and he didn't go all the way through the Passover session, you know, and Judas is still there at this time. Judas has already done his betrayal, and he's still there during this procedure. We're not exactly sure when the washing of the disciples' feet, whether it was before, during, or after the meal, but it looks like it was toward the end of the meal or right after the meal, okay? And so we're going to start there in the middle of page 25 at reading from the Gospel of John. And John is the only writer that records this event on that night. Then he, Jesus, poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. And so he came to Simon Peter. He said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered and said to him, "What I do you do not now realize, but you shall understand hereafter." Peter said to him, "Never shall you wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, then you have no part with me." Simon Peter says to him, "Lord, not my feet only then, but also my hands and my head." You know, he's always going to go the extra mile here and, you know, overstate it. So Jesus said to him, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you." For he knew the one who was betraying him. For this reason, he said, "Not all of you are clean." And so when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined at the table again, he said to them, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should also do as I did to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, neither is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. I do not speak of all of you. I know the ones I have chosen, but it is that the Scripture may be fulfilled, 'He who eats my bread has lifted up his heel against me.' From now on, I am telling you before it comes to pass, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am he. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me." Okay. So on the top of 26, there's a number of elements in here that are important, and a couple of them that have to do with Greek words that we'll get into when we talk about bathing and washing. The two different words that are used there that correspond to our experiences on this side of the cross. So let's look at the commentators on page 26. He rises from the supper, that is, from the couch on which he had been reclining. Now, remember the way they ate, their tables were about coffee table high. In the center of the room, they would have been laying on cushions, like dominoes, back to back, leaning on their side. And so he gets up after supper, rises from the supper. So this may be during the meal or after the meal. This shows that the feet washing which follows was not before the supper, because he rises from the supper, and so is not to be regarded as the cleansing of the feet which was preparatory to a meal. Where sandals are worn, the feet get dusty and tired, obviously from walking around the dusty roads. And it was a courtesy of hospitality to arrange that water was available for washing them. Which when you went into a Jewish home in those days and for the longest time afterwards, there was always a basin to wash your feet when you came in because you were dusty from the road to the house. And generally they had a servant there, a slave, that would do the foot washing for you, you know, with a bowl and a basin and stuff like that to get off the dusty roads of Galilee and Jerusalem. And that was almost like in the traditional Asian societies where you take off your shoes before you go in. You know, it's a similar kind of to keep from bringing outside dirt into the house. But in this case, the supper had not only begun, but was probably ending. In the talk that followed, the disciples began to dispute about their precedence. It was who was the greatest among them. Okay? Perhaps in reference to the order in which they were placed at the meal. You know, I'm sitting closer to Jesus, that means I'm more important. You know, that kind of thing, right? And Jesus, rising from his place, proceeds to give them an object lesson. Whether is greater, he that sitteth at meat or he that serveth? Is it not he that sits at the table eating? But I am in the midst of you as one that serveth. So stripping off his outer robe or talith and appearing in his tunic only, he girded himself with a towel, as a slave would do, that he might pour water upon their feet. Whetstone, an ancient commentator, records the story of Caligula, that horrible Roman emperor Caligula, who was wont to insult members of the Roman Senate by making them wait at table in a short linen outfit. So you think the linen tail. So it was like you've seen in the high churches, the Catholic and Episcopal churches, the altar boys that have the little robes, and a linen robe would be of just like the outer garment that would only go like to the mid-thigh. And so that's what a very short linen thing, and slaves would wear that, and that's what Caligula did. He would take high-ranking members of the Senate and force them to dress up like that and serve at his table. It was the ultimate insult. And this story indicates how great an act of condescension the feet washing by Christ must have seemed to his disciples. Now, they might not be as familiar with the Roman custom of the highbrow. You know, I mean, they've never even been in one of those houses. John, the Apostle John, though, was. Remember, the person that wrote this was a friend of the high priest. So, I mean, he was the one that gets into the courtyard and brings Peter in. So, I mean, some of them had circles in there, you know, of that. But anybody reading the Gospel of John afterwards, any of the Greeks, any of the leaders, you know, of the ancient world that would have read that would have just been shocked at this act of condescension. Humility was not a virtue, by the way, in Greco-Roman society. I mean, we consider humility and humbleness most of the time to be good, you know, a mark of virtue and things of this type. That was not the case in Roman times, in Roman and Greco-Roman culture. Humility was a lie if you were high-born. See, to act below your station was a lie in that ancient world. And so you were not allowed to show pity and compassion and humility and things of this type. It was not becoming. It was disgraceful. It was a vice at some level. It's not all the time. There are places where leaders are exhorted by the philosophers of the day, the moral philosophers, to be more humble and less arrogant, but it would never go to this limit, to this level of being a servant to all. Never would go that far. That would just be unthinkable. The answer of Jesus to Simon Peter, "If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me," is very severe. Sounds very severe when you read that. To have part with one another, or to be his partner, however, is to share in his work, and ultimately in his reward. That's what part. It's sort of like you have no partnership with me. If you don't let me do this, you have no partnership with me. And we're not in this together. We're on separate roads, and we have different futures. We have different value sets. Thus, the unfaithful slave, in another passage, is condemned to have his part with the hypocrites. So there's that a parable that Jesus tells about this, and his portion of an unfaithful servant is not, his portion is not with the master and the household and the welfare, it's with the hypocrites outside. The Levites had no part in the inheritance of Israel, their work being different from that of the other tribes. You know, it's when God told Moses to divide up the land of Israel, right when they go in and they're going to break up the land, he says, cut it in 11 pieces, not 12. There were 12 tribes, 12 sons of Jacob, one of whom was Levi. Levi was going to become the traveling teachers, the preachers. And so they didn't make a whole lot of sense to give them a section of the land and them all just stay there and not teach anybody but one another. Right? So they said, no, what we're going to do is we're going to cut the land in 11 pieces for the 11 other tribes. And Levi has no inheritance there in those lands, and we'll disperse them in Israel. We'll give them cities, places to live, and pasture lands, but we'll spread them throughout so there will always be an opportunity for them to share the Word of God with somebody, or people may come to them for judgment and things of this type. Simon Magus, in the book of Acts, had no part with the apostolic endowments of the Spirit, being animated by ideals wholly different from those of the apostles. That's another illustration from Acts. A Christian has no part with an unbelieving heathen in terms of future destination and things of that type. Sometimes the values are even sharper in contrast. So, to decline the call of ministry to which every disciple is called is to have no part with Christ, to be no partner of his, for his work was preeminently a work of ministry. That's what Jesus came to do, was to serve. He said, I've come to serve and give my life for many. Peter's refusal to allow his master to minister to him through the foot washing was really to reject the principle of the dignity of ministry and service which was behind the work of Jesus. When the very Son of God came to earth to do just this, and to sit there and say, well, I'm not going to let you do this to me. See, you've repudiated probably one of the greatest things in all the universe. You've said, I realize that this is an immense step on your part as the Son of God to do this, immense thing of love, but I'm not going to let you do that to me. And that's a repudiation. That's a rejection of God's purpose and God's plan that was pretty strong. Now, Lewine is frequently used of bathing the whole body. Remember in the passage he says, where he comes up to Simon Peter, and Simon Peter says, you'll never wash my, I'm not going to let you be a servant to me, a slave, a common, lowly slave like that to me. And then Jesus says, if you don't, you have no part with me. Then Peter overreacts and said, well, if you're going to bathe part of me, then just go ahead and hose me down. You know, bathe all of them. My head and my hand and my feet and all that stuff, right? And Jesus says at that point, he says, no, he who has luoed, big bath, needs only a nipto, a little bath. And they're two separate words and they mean two separate things. And that's what this luon is. Luon is frequently used of bathing the whole body. That's a total wash. Guests were accompanied to bathe, big bath, before they went to a feast. Of course, you'd bathe at home, right? You'd bathe and be all gussied up, and you know, when you went over to the feast. But when they arrived at the house, they were to have, where they were to have dinner or supper, it was only necessary that their feet should be washed. There was no need for the head or the hands to be washed. That didn't really get dusty in the sandals. And so Jesus reminds Peter, who has been wrong in thinking that the washing of his feet by his master was for the purpose of bodily cleansing. The man who has bathed before the meal is katharos, holos, holy clean. And Jesus adds of the disciples who were present, you are all clean. Now, the message there is that the disciples, with the exception of Judas, see, it all trusted the Lord. But they were like us. They didn't know what was going on, you know. I mean, they trusted the Lord. They walked with him. And they had, because of forgiveness of sins, that big bath. They had that big bath, and that big bath would last forever for them. That's what forgiveness of sin is like. It's just that nip, it's that luo, and it's just there forever. You enter that thing, and you say, Lord, I forgive, you know. And a lot of times you don't even know when you're really asking. You know, I mean, we stumble into this thing so much that if I get to Jesus and just pour my heart out before him, he'll fix things. You know, he'll help me in my life. And sometimes that's God has this great heart for forgiving our imprecision. You know, when we can't say things precisely because you just don't know, he looks through to the heart. And so we'll get the big bath when we just put our faith in the Lord and trust in the Lord and what he did on the cross. And that's the big bath. But then we don't get to stay there in the tub. We have to get out and go live. We have to go out there and we have to walk around, and invariably we make little mistakes. We get our feet dirty. We get dirty in this process, and that's when we just go back to the Lord and say, I just need, you know, I'm accumulating dirt and it's getting heavy on my feet. Can you help me with this? Lord, I've done this wrong and I didn't do this right, and you know. And that's the little bath. That's just to keep what they call short accounts with God. I mean, if I show up in heaven with dirt on my feet, he's not going to kick me out for that because I've had the big bath. I've had the big bath. See? But he will wash my feet day by day. The Apostle John, who wrote the passage here, writes in 1 John that says, if we say we have no sin, we lie and deceive ourselves, and we're still sinners. But if we have sinned, we have an advocate with Jesus Christ, with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. And the blood of Christ cleanses us, continually cleanses us from all sin. So there's that walk with God after you get the big bath of just in faith in him and trust in him that he's in charge of your future and your destination. And then it's just coming to him periodically on a routine basis, a regular basis, and saying, Lord, I really messed that up. And that wasn't just ignorance. There was a little selfishness in what I did there. And that's the little bath. That's the little nip toes of the world where you just need a little cleansing. And that's what he was trying to tell him. He said, no, you guys that are not all of you, one of you is not. One of you never took that step, that big bath step. They never learned that. But so you don't need to get saved over and over and over again. I mean, that's just one big bath. And then there are times in our lives where we just have to go back and say, Lord, I've messed up again here, and I just need a little foot washing, you know. here's an illustration. They made this in seminary. We had they were trying to train us to be preachers, right? And most of us to be preachers or counselors or different things, but most generally pastors. One of the things, the courses, the practical courses on preaching and things like that, we had to write sermons and stuff like this. I was just lousy, really lousy at that. But one of the things that pastors have to do, and you know this from hearing preachers, that they have to have illustrations. They've got to have little stories and little illustrations to illustrate the point. And so we had assignments in preaching classes to go start our, building our illustration file. And so we had to go research books on illustrations, and we had to start building the 3x5 file cards back in those days, you know. And so I had to go find three. The assignment was to find three illustrations of anything in the Gospels, right? And I don't remember anything about this, and like I said, this was not my strong suit. But the one illustration I got, it stuck with me forever because it just, you know, that's what the illustrations are for. Stick, you know, you'll long forget everything else the pastor says except that illustration. That's why they're so powerful. And it's one where somebody dies and goes to heaven, and they're giving them a tour of things from the life of Christ. And so they've got like a museum set up of things from the life of Christ. And St. Peter, or whoever is taking them through this, is saying, it's in one room, it said, now here's the little, the manger. Here's the little wooden cradle from his, I can't tell this with a straight face, with a, you know, where he was born. And over here is one of the, you know, the cloth that he wore. You know, when he was coming into the city of Jerusalem, they put the prayer shawl on him. Over here are some of the palms from the day that he comes in. He goes through this, and the person notices after a while, he says, well, you know, and then they're done. He said, well, where is the bowl? So, you know, the washing in the bowl. And he said, oh, he's still using that. He's still washing the bowl of this event. You know, he remembered this event from the life of Christ. He said, so where is the bowl? And the says, well, he's still using that. He's still using that. And that's that continual cleansing that he does in our life. And that's the luo and the nipto, and the big bath and little bath. And that's important to remember when you get really discouraged about your relationship with the Lord. If you didn't have the big bath, you would not care about being discouraged. You know, when you're not worried about your relationship with God, that means you don't have one. It's when you do have one that you get worried about it. You know, because that's the heart that says, you know, I could do maybe a little better, or I could do a little less and be better. Because some people are over busy, you know, and get away from the Lord by being over busy. You know, get lost in the minutia. And some people get lost by just not doing enough sowing and of goodness and sweetness in life. And we go from one extreme to the next and things of this type. But it's sometimes to remember that when you're concerned about it, that you wouldn't be concerned if he wasn't involved in your life at that particular point. It's a good sign when you worry about that, because it reminds you that he's in there pursuing you. Okay, the menial nature of foot washing in Jewish eyes is seen in its inclusion among works which Jewish slaves should not be required to do. Yeah, the later rabbis said that it's so low to wash feet that you should never make even a Jewish slave do it. Okay? The task was reserved for Gentile slaves and for wives and children. And those little rabbis, you know, they said, only these people, you know, should have to do something that lowly. I mean, it tells you a lot about those guys, you know. It is one of the sweetest things. The Apostle Paul, he was trained this way, right? And there's a rabbinic prayer in the Jewish literature where the rabbi thanks God for not making him a woman, a slave, or a Gentile. And so Paul, when he sees what's going on here with Jesus, and the new life in Christ, there's a section, twice actually, in the Ephesians or Colossians where he says, "For in Christ Jesus there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for we are all one in Christ." Such a change had happened to this heart by seeing the freedom and a way Jesus treated people, slaves, females, and Gentiles, that it completely reversed everything he'd been trained in. All the little bigotry and all the little arrogance and all this kind of stuff, that we saw it clearly that this was. It was just a beautiful, beautiful statement. But this was, again, this was a reflection of how low Jesus stepped in this lesson in the eyes of Jewish leadership. See, to do foot washing as a Jewish leader, even. The task was reserved for Gentile slaves and for wives and children. The action of Jesus in removing his outer garment and tying a towel around him underscores the humiliation of his action. The Midrash, which is the Jewish commentary on Genesis 21, states that when Abraham sent Hagar, his Egyptian concubine, away, he gave her a bill of divorce and took her shawl and girded it around her loins that people should know that she was a slave. So when you pour that little towel around you, that was a mark of slavery and your humiliation. So the fact that he deliberately did this in this culture, said he wanted everybody to be clear that he wasn't being patronizing when he do it. He was going all the way down there. Because people would have seen it, you know, people could have seen this and misinterpreted it and said, yep, that's the humility. Okay, so they're the Passover, they're maybe a little ways through the thing. And remember, one of the comments was saying they were arguing about who is the greatest. Remember, they used to have arguments. These disciples just never seemed to get this. What was funny is they would fall behind Jesus in walking, and then they would start talking among themselves as to which one of them was the greatest disciple. You're right, you know, I'm the greatest. You're the obviously the greatest. They were saying, I'm obviously the greatest. He picked me, and we did this, and he had these private talks, you know. And every now and then, once or twice, Jesus will stop and says, he'll let them catch up. So what were you guys talking about? And you don't know whether they'll own up to what they're talking about, you know, because they know it's wrong, you know. And the famous scene is where one time he says, "Gosh, you know, you guys don't get it. Go get a little kid here, you know." And he brings a little kid and he sits in his lap and he says, "To you won't even make it into the kingdom unless you're humble like this little kid." You know, not even a matter of who's, you know, king of the hill here. You're not even going to make it unless you abandon all that stuff. It has nothing to do with it. And so it could be like the seating again here, that they might have tried to read that as some kind of religious thing. And so this foot washing was a preeminent sign of how far God would go, both to minister to us as well as teach us an example, to show us what he was like. See, God didn't come in that splendor and all this kind of stuff, literally coming into the manger, you know, as humble. You know, I mean, he just literally changed all our notions of what God was like in the ancient world. God was always big. God was always powerful and demanded, you know, you bow down. And, you know, he was arrogant. He was after the arrogant model. But when the Jesus who said he was seeing me has seen the Father, you want to see what God saw, you look at me. Watch. As a matter of fact, specifically, watch now. I'm going to wash your feet like the lowest servant. This is what the heart of God is like. He's not about statue or privilege. It's about helping. It's about serving and loving. Okay, so they're there at the... They're there at the table. This happens. We have Judas goes out toward the end of the meal to get the priest to bring them. And now they're going to go to the Garden of Gethsemane. So we're now on page 27. name. The name is mentioned in Matthew and Mark as the piece of land or field to which Jesus and his disciples retiring followed the Last Supper. In John 18, it is described as a garden, from which comes the traditional designation Garden of Gethsemane. While Luke 22 simply has place. From John 18, it is evident that it was across the Kidron. And from Luke 22:39, it was on the slope of the Mount of Olives. So if you remember in all our maps, when we draw the city, we have, in the city, we've got, our city, the wall here, we've got the temple here. The city at that particular point looks a little bit like something like that. We've got, and it's up on the high, and there's that plain that goes down from it. We've got that river, that brook, Kidron Brook. Remember that deep drop-off that we looked at in the map last time, you know. And then there's this gradual slope up to this area over here, the Mount of Olives. That's that highest point. All right, and this is, so... They would have had, remember, they would have probably eaten the Last Supper. They had to eat it inside the walls. And they would have gone out, one of these gates, gone across the brook, and gone into the Garden of Gethsemane, which was up higher. So you still could see the city from over there. But they have made this journey after Judas has left and gone over to probably the high priest quarters. So they have that scene where how Judas leaves. You know, Jesus gets very, very emotional at the end of this meal, and he says, "Amen, amen, I say to you, one of you will betray me this night." And they start arguing among themselves about who it will be, right? Who it was, because this is shock to them. He has not mentioned anything like treachery before, coming from their own. He's always talked about the Pharisees and the leaders were going to kill him, you know, and evil thinkers. But there was no thought that the disciples would betray him. And so that's where we have that scene where they discuss it, and Peter, who's not at the head of the table, says to John, who's leaning on Jesus' breast. So he's, you know, John is sitting at the table. Jesus is right behind him. Judas is probably right over behind Jesus at the place of honor. And so Peter is probably over this way, and he motions to John. He whispers, he motions to John to ask which one it is. And John leans back to Jesus, says, "Who is it, Lord?" Right? And they're discussing among themselves who it could be. They're trying to, and you wonder, because it doesn't say there, how they were arguing. You don't know whether they're saying, I bet it's old so-and-so. They're judging. They're being critical of others. Or they're saying, "Is it me? Is it me?" In other words, they may have learned enough about themselves going into the Last Supper to recognize that every one of them is a potential Judas. It's only at that level of honesty, you know, clarity of heart, that you know that inside you is something that would do something like that in the right circumstances or the wrong circumstances. So I don't know who's, but they were questioning about who it was, and so he turns and says, "It is him that I give the sop, the meat that I give the bread." And so in the ceremony, you dip your bread in the meat sauce. And the first one went to the guest of honor, and Jesus gives that, of course, to Judas. And then he turns to Judas and he says, what you do, do quickly. Go ahead and get it done. We need to move forward. Judas gets up and leaves. And it's at that point he has John 14 through 17, which is all Jesus' words about the Holy Spirit. And they're more intimate information that he gives his disciples after Judas leaves. And then they get up and they go to the Garden of Gethsemane. So they're now, they've gone out here, they're walking up here. Judas knows, of course, where this is. I'm sorry, I'm getting inner ear problems from this. Is that better? I'm going to start sitting crooked here if I'm not careful here. All right, so they go up, they go to the garden. Its name suggests a grove of olive trees, as does its location on the Mount of Olives. The language of John's Gospel seems to imply a walled garden. So, a lot of, remember, vineyards and stuff like that, one of your first tasks was to build a garden, you know, a little wall around it for animals and just passerbys and things of this type. So it may have been a walled garden. The terms in which the experience of Gethsemane is described in the Gospel speak of the deepest sorrow and suffering. Luke 22:44 used the word agony to speak of our Lord's experience, thus implying a great strain or struggle. And it is Luke who gave the physical description. His sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Jesus' words of warning to his disciples and his prayer imply that he regarded the event in terms of a temptation from which he emerged victoriously. He said, sit here and pray that you do not enter into temptation. Okay, now he's tempted very seriously, and I think I'm going to interject that material here in a minute. The next paragraph. The name Gethsemane derives from Hebrew and Aramaic word for oil press. Presumably Gethsemane consisted of an olive orchard and an oil press to squeeze oil from the olives, both of which were common on the Mount of Olives. There would be scores of these. The garden must have been fairly large because Jesus led Peter, James, and John away from the rest of the disciples. And later Jesus withdrew further in order to pray alone. Early Christians conceived of Gethsemane as analogous to the Garden of Eden in the divine plan of human redemption. The sinful actions of the first Adam in the Garden of Eden are contrasted with the prayerful obedience of the second Adam, Jesus Christ. Other Christians claim that Jesus' example in Gethsemane gave rise to the custom of kneeling for prayer. Now, in this garden, he takes his group of 11 disciples, and he goes into the garden as was common. They're going to sleep there. They're going to bivouac there. That's a common place. Then he takes his inner circle, Peter, James, and John, the three that were sort of the leaders there, and they were leaders and pillars in the early church. And they go further, and he asks them to sit there and pray, pray and watch that you enter not temptation. Then he goes off what's called a stone's throw away from them, and he goes into this immense prayer of agony. And preparing for this, I rented and watched The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson's thing again last night, to see if there were elements that I need to make sure. And I remember the first time I watched it, I didn't think much about it, but the agony that Jesus goes in through in the garden is out of proportion to just dying, even dying on a cross. In other words, Jesus is the most fearless character we've ever known. He could care less. He came to die. And he's always just going straight into danger. And he's the one that's going to lay down his life. And, he has no fear of this whatsoever. I mean, he has no fear of pain. He's human. He wrestles with it. But not at this level of agony. Not at this level of the cup passed from me and, if possible, take this, angels and something else is going on other than death and crucifixion, his awareness of that. And we know that it's because that he bore the sin of the world. So this is the holiest person, the most sensitive of hearts that's ever been a human. You know, God's heart came there, and he's confronted with the thing that he came to do was to become a sin bearer. Take the sin off of us and put it on him. And that is a horror to this heart. That's just amazing. I mean, you know, that's just unthinkable, of becoming the most repulsive thing in the universe. I mean, you know, we are dull, and therefore we don't see sin and evil at the same level of horror that God does. He knows what it does. It tears holes in the universe that he has to fix. And to fix it requires the death of his son. And so, I mean, there's an element in this agony that's so beyond just death and crucifixion, and the pain of the, and you can't depict this on the, you know, in a movie. You can emphasize the physical pain of the crucifixion and things of that type. That's easy to do, but thousands of Jews were crucified like that, but none of them bore my sin, and none of them dealt with the wrath of God poured upon them because of my sin. And so none of them were betrayed necessarily by God after eternity of communion and closeness for Glenn's sin. See? And so that's the prospect that's so amazing. And so the agony of Jesus is that that's his last point of getting off the plane. That's his last chance to get off this train. And this train is going to go to, you know, it's going to create a brand new universe with us in it. And the hope for all of us to become members of this new future and get freedom from this. And the prospect of how you get from here to there goes through this cross. Sin bearing, which is just an amazing thing where the communion of the Father and the Son is going to be broken. So the garden has got a tremendous number of lessons in it that hopefully the preachers will cover at Easter, you know, in the sermons here. We were mostly doing background, but I did want to mention that's when you look at that, it's so much larger than just the death and the pain of somebody that, you know, that didn't mean anything to, you know, by itself, you know. So, betrayal and arrest. And while he was still speaking, this was there in the garden, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a great multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now he who was betraying him gave them a sign, saying, whomsoever I shall kiss, he is the one, seize him. And immediately he went to Jesus and said, hail, Rabbi, and kissed him. And Jesus said to him, friend, do what you have come for. Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus, this ends up being Peter, because we're going to read all the accounts here, Peter, reached and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But how then shall the Scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen this way? At that time Jesus said to the multitudes, the crowd around him, have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as against a robber? Every day I used to sit in the temple of teaching, and you did not seize me then. But all this has taken place that the Scriptures of the prophets may be fulfilled. Then all the disciples left him and fled. Okay, now, in this, Jesus is boldly going out to his death. He's in control here. Nobody's. He's already told him. He says, No man takes my life from me. I lay it down. I have the authority to lay it down and to take it back up again. I mean, nobody's killing me. I am going to my death by my choice, and I will die when I choose to. Only God can sort of do that. Okay? So he's definitely in command here. So that's the Matthew passage. Now from John 18, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden into which he himself entered and his disciples. Now Jesus also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Pretty common place, overlooking the city, quad. Judas then, having received the cohort, and a cohort is a band of soldiers, and officers from the chief priest and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So they probably would have gone out, maybe the same gate. They would have gone out the same gate and going to this place where, Judas knows him to be. Jesus, therefore, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to this crowd that came out, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with him. When therefore he said to them, "I am him," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again, therefore, he asked them, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. If therefore you seek me, let these," his disciples, "go their way, that the word might be fulfilled which he spoke, 'Of those whom thou hast given me, I lost not one.'" Simon Peter, therefore, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. The slave's name was Malchus. Jesus, therefore, said to Peter, "Put the sword into its sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" This is that cup of suffering, the cup of judgment. The cup was always judgment. In the Old Testament, the prophets would go up and they would talk about the cup of judgment that would fall upon Assyria or Moab, or that God would prepare a cup and that they would drink it all the way down to the bottom. It was the cup of judgment, God's wrath being poured out. And when Jesus says, "The cup which the Father has given me, will I not drink it? Should I not drink that?" That's that judgment, that thing that he had already prayed in the garden, "If it is possible, Father, let this cup pass from me." In other words, if there is any way else to save these people other than me becoming sin and wrath from that, can we do that? "Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." There was no other way. There was no other way. "Shall I not drink it?" So the cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him into Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. Okay, now, so they take him, they arrest him here. They could bring him in one of these gates over here north of the temple, and go around the temple and come into the high priest's quarters. But there are two people here. There's Annas, who's the father-in-law of Caiaphas. The Caiaphas is the official high priest. He's the one that we talked about was buddy-buddy with Pilate, with Pontius Pilate, that they were together and, they worked together well. And then when they were deposed, they were both gone at the same time. They were axed at the same time. Well, Caiaphas's father-in-law, Annas, had already been deposed by a previous guy. And he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, but he still has all this power. He's got the influence of a father-in-law, and he was deposed in 15 A.D. But he's still a figure. He goes around, he gives advice to his son-in-law, and so they go to his house first. And then they go, he does a little sort of trial, does some examination of Jesus, and then they'll go to Caiaphas' house, which is the official high priest courtyard thing that we talked about. Okay? Although there are certain points of contact between John's account and the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this record of the betrayal is mainly peculiar to John. John alone mentions the name of the valley where the garden was situated, whereas the synoptics tell us the garden was called Gethsemane. Although John does not mention the agony in the garden, he knew about it. Verse 11, the reference to the cup. His comment that Judas knew the garden because of the disciples that often met Jesus there looks like an eyewitness observation. John has been there. He done that. I mean, he was part of that group. The aim of the detachment of the soldiers would have been to maintain order, to augment the temple police. Remember, this is Passover. He got all these extra security guards there for this. The I am in verse 5. See, it doesn't say I am he. It says I am. There's no Greek he in that. When they come and said, who do you seek? Jesus of Nazareth. All he says is Yahweh. Basically, he says I am. And that's what the word Yahweh, Old Testament word for Yahweh was I am. He doesn't say, I am he. He just says, I am. And when he had said that before to the Jews, they picked up stones to kill him because he was claiming deity. So the Jewish people might have caught on what he was saying as he did a double entendre, both to identify himself as well as make this extreme claim. The I am in verse 5 does not appear to carry the same implications as the earlier sayings. It might not be that. Although the fact that the questioners fell back suggests that they were overawed by more than a mere assent of identity. In other words, just because he said, I am he, that's not enough to make them fall down. Something else was bigger there in that statement, that pronouncement of Jesus. Their staggering was, however, only temporary. There was no ongoing recognition of the extraordinary character of Jesus. The request of Jesus that the disciples should be allowed to go is found only in John. Verse 9 is seen as a fulfillment of the statement of Jesus in 17:12. I've lost none. It is surprising that Peter was carrying a sword. It is possible that it was some kind of dagger. The act of striking the servant's ear was clearly one of desperation. Courageous, but pointless. Okay. John alone mentions the servant's name, Malchus. Remember, John is the one who knows the high priest. Remember, John is the one that when they go in to Caiaphas, John's going to come in because the gatekeeper knows John. John may have been the supplier of fish to that household. He's a commercial fisherman. And so he gets in and he tells them to let Peter come in. That's how we get Peter in the courtyard for the three denials of Jesus. Right? And so John knows the high priest, and John would know Malchus, his name. That made perfect sense. Okay? The reference to the cup seems to be a clear allusion to the experience in Gethsemane recorded by the synoptics. Peter had not yet grasped Jesus' determination to follow through his mission. Now, Jesus had been telling them for at least 18 months that it was time, he was now going to Jerusalem to die. And that he would be seized by the high priest and the chief rulers and be spit upon and beaten and humiliated and crucified. He consistently said this. He never said, and I'm going to duck as soon as it comes. He says, I'm going there. This is what I'm here for, etc. And up to this moment, Peter had still not gotten that's what he came to do. He wasn't just going to leave us here. I mean, I remember in Cincinnati, I was living in Cincinnati, commuting back from San Jose, I went to an Easter service, and I was in the Sunday school, I was somehow a helper. I can't remember how this worked out, because I didn't attend the church, but somehow I volunteered and got it into some play thing. I was like one of the crowd that yelled things out, and it was like a high school group or something like this. And the scene is in the garden, and there's a scene in the garden where the soldiers and all this is happening, and there's another scene where there's God the Father up in the throne of heaven, and the archangels like the military archangels are there by his side. And so Jesus goes through these steps, and he's in this betrayal mode, and the angels keep saying, okay, now do we go to the Father? Now do we intervene? That's the 12 legions. And the Father keeps saying, no, not yet. Not yet. And so they go to this scene, and the angels, they may not have gotten this. They may not have understood this themselves, because the bad angels didn't get it. They missed the point altogether of what this was for. They gleefully participated in stirring up the crowd. The bad folk did this only to find themselves defeated by this death. But the good angels may not have understood it fully themselves, but they kept asking as things got worse and more dark and more desperate for Jesus, the Son of God. They kept saying, well, surely now you want us to intervene and save him? And the Father kept saying, no, not yet. And so this, he could have called. But the thing that stopped him was there was no way to stop it. He could have stopped. He could have said, everybody's betrayed me. My closest friends have betrayed me, abandoned me, and completely missed everything I taught them. Here's Peter cutting their head, you know, trying to cut the guy's head off. You know, I'm completely misunderstood. Everybody's abandoned me. These people aren't worth it. The race, just as a, they're just, they aren't worth it. And he could have stopped and said, yep, okay, now do it. Bring it down, let's forget this mess, and let them wallow in their own stuff. But he kept going. Such was love that he just kept going. Next page. Kidron Valley is literally winter swollen Kidron. This brook flowed only in the rainy season, during winter, so crossing it in April would not involve even getting wet. There's just nothing there, you know. Jesus and his disciples had met there other times. Many scholars have noted that this military contingent that came with Judas is described in a manner much like Roman cohorts. And sometimes it's translated that way. Nevertheless, the same language was also used of Jewish units. And this unit is undoubtedly Jewish, the Temple Guard. In other words, they were the private, they were the Jerusalem police force as opposed to the National Guard, so to speak. The National Guard might have been the Romans. Okay? Roman troops would not be used for routine police action like this. They weren't police of that type. And the Romans would not have taken Jesus to the house of the Jewish high priest. They would have taken him straight to their leadership, whom they had deposed in 15 A.D. A full cohort in the Roman sense would have involved 800 soldiers. See? But a detachment from the cohort is all that John need mean here. Both the temple police and the Romans carried torches. Two kinds are mentioned here. At night, although only a few need have carried them, especially since the moon would be nearly full at Passover. There'd be a full moon. There are no buildings. I mean, this is open space. You know, this is open land, a garden. An olive grove is not like we would have an olive grove. It's very sparse in trees. I am can mean I am he whom you seek, but it can also allude to Exodus 3:14, I am that I am, what the name of God means, Yahweh, in the Old Testament, translated literally. A Jewish tradition, purportedly pre-Christian, attributed to the early diaspora Jewish writer Artapanus, said that when Moses pronounced the name of his God, Pharaoh fell backward. Yeah, that's not in the Bible, but that's in a Jewish tradition that said when he said, Moses said, you know, the holy name of God, I am, that Pharaoh fell backward. Okay. If Jesus' hearers had thought he was pronouncing the divine name, they might also have fallen back in fear because magicians were said to try to cast spells in that name. So that's very common in the spell tablets, and I've got literally 10,000, I've got a book that's got 10,000 curses and spells from the ancient world. And they always invoke the name of big figures, you know, famous figures, and a lot of them by this time have already were you know, calling on Jehovah, Yahweh, and angels, and you know, as part of the curse to do this spell, whatever they're doing, you know. So if Jesus had led with this, a group of people who didn't know much about him or his teacher may have assumed that he was about to pronounce a curse on them, which everybody took very seriously in that day. It was actually a capital offense in parts of the Roman Empire to do magic. It was actually, I mean, they were so afraid of that. Generally, it was the senators that were afraid of somebody doing magic at them so they wouldn't get reelected. They would die early. And that shows up in the literature a lot. They say, and they'll have a court where somebody will lose an election or a lawyer will lose a case, and they'll go find somebody and file suit against him for having messed up the jury or the election by casting a spell on the loser. And so they'll blame it not on their popularity or lack of crowd appeal, but on somebody, some mischief maker, and then no doubt put them to death, okay? Jesus left the room where he ate the Last Supper with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley to the east. The Kidron is a valley or torrent bed which starts north of Jerusalem and passes between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives, as we've noted many times, on the way, its way to the Dead Sea. It doesn't make it all the way. David was betrayed by a friend, Ahithophel, while crossing the Kidron and going up to the Mount of Olives. So too Jesus was betrayed by his trusted friend, Judas, while crossing the Kidron and going to the Mount of Olives. Now, this is we mentioned this in the Psalms where we were talking about the rebellion of David's oldest son, Absalom. There was a situation where Absalom decided to take the throne from David, and Absalom leaves the city, and he's kissed up to all the leaders, and everybody loves him, and he's a gorgeous guy, and everybody loves him. He's just a perfect, you know, TV figure. You know, and he goes and he takes all the leading men with him out of the city, and they're going to go off. They're going to go down to a real holy place, 17 miles below there, up to Hebron, home of, you know, where Abraham was buried, this famous place. And then he's going to be announced king. Well, David had two trusted counselors. These are like, they would be like the attorney general or whoever, like, is the closest person in the White House, you know. That's why attorney generals might be your brother or somebody. Somebody that really trusted and knew this stuff. He had two of them. David had Hushai and Ahithophel. And Ahithophel betrays David and goes with Absalom. David gets wind that his son is probably going to come and kill him and take over the throne. And so David leaves Jerusalem with his trusted people and some of the priests and some of the people that didn't defect. And he goes out probably a very similar, of course, it looked different. The city of David was down here. But he would have gone roughly across the same way at the same time that Ahithophel, his closest counselor, was betraying him with Absalom. So a Jewish reader that knew that story would see perhaps a parallel with the son of David being betrayed by one of his closest and most dependable friends. Remember, Judas was the treasurer of the group. He was the one who kept the bag, as John said. And so whenever there were donations, they gave it to Judas because he was the best, most worldly-minded and practical-minded individual, and he kept the bag. But John pointed out that sometimes he took finder's fee on all the money that came in because it said that he helped himself. John used the phrase, he helped himself. And so when the disciples see Jesus give Judas the sop, you know, that milk, that bread dipped in the thing, and he said, "What you do, go quickly," and he leaves, the Gospels record that said, and they supposed that Jesus had told Judas to go give something to the poor out of the bag. And so they had no reason to mistrust Judas. He was a perfect religious figure up to this moment. trusted religious leader, did everything perfect, even went out on the missionary trips, cast out demons, you know, preached the gospel. Everything was just perfect about this guy, you know. And he was just so trusted in this group. Okay, let's see, where was it? Okay, I love this one. Jesus left the room. The Kidron. David was betrayed by a friend. So too, Jesus was betrayed by his trusted friend, Judas, while crossing the Kidron and going to the Mount of Olives. These next couple of sentences I love. The olive grove was a place where Jesus and his disciples came each night to bivouac when they were in Jerusalem. Peter had promised that he would die for Jesus. You know, he said, wherever you go, I'll die. And he thought perhaps he could save Jesus or at least go down fighting. I love this next sentence. Undoubtedly, he was better at fishing than at sword play. Right? For he no doubt tried to take off the head of the high priest's servant, Malchus, and not just his ear. You know? So, I mean, he was a commercial fisherman, obviously not his soldier, you know. Both Luke and John recorded that it was his right ear, which is an incidental evidence of the historical reliability of the gospel books. Luke added that Jesus healed the man's ear, an amazing touch of love for his enemies. So, he cut Peter in an act of no telling what, just bravado, or just zeal without knowledge, cuts off his ear. Jesus stops the proceedings that's going on here and heals this individual. Now, all the way through this passion, from here until his resurrection, he will stop and minister to people. He will stop in the middle of all this. He'll take care of his mother. He will stop for the thief on the cross that accepts him. Here he stops and heals his worst enemy's trusted servant, Malchus. He stops. And I remember thinking about this first time I read this, and I said, so Malchus never looked at Jesus the same ever since. So the next 2 or 3 hours of trials and brutality, here's this Malchus who recognizes that there was zero reason for this individual to stop what he was and heal him. You know his life was changed. There's no question. I mean, you just can't look at this figure the same after an act like that. Peter's blind loyalty was touching, but it missed God's plan. Zeal without knowledge in religion often leads men astray. It was unlawful to carry arms on a feast day. See, they weren't supposed to be carrying swords. And although at such a crisis, an eager disciple like Peter would probably have no scruple in breaking the law if the safety of his master was at stake. The fact that two of the company had knives with them earlier in the evening tends to show that the Last Supper was not the full Passover. But at the same time, like I say, it was sort of a half Passover, a pre-Passover, so maybe they thought it was okay for me to bring my sword. You know, what they were doing with the sword, because Jesus said, you know, he gives them a parable there at the end. He says, remember how I sent you out without a sword or a tunic or a bag of money, you know, and told you to go this way? Well, now go sell your cloak and buy a sword. And it's a metaphorical thing that said things are about to get tough for you. And there's that scene where then the disciples say, well, here are two swords, Lord. And Jesus says, that's plenty. And you don't know whether he was discouraged that they missed the point. In the Jesus film, a beautiful thing, I have thought more than once about us watching that just one night. It's an hour and a half, but it's the entire life of Christ. But in that scene, you have the character that's playing Jesus where he's talking figuratively, you know. And they said, well, here's two swords, Lord. And you see the actor just express this on his face, just this act of just resigned frustration, like, that's plenty. You know, it's that kind of look. You know, okay, that's plenty. Let's move on. You know, you missed this one. Let's try again here. You know, so they weren't actually supposed to have that, but a kiss was a sign of special affection. among family members and close friends, or of a disciple's honor and affection for his teacher. Judas's kiss is thus a special act of hypocrisy. Proverbs 27:6 says, deceitful are the trust of the kisses of an enemy. Treacherous are the kisses of an enemy. Given ancient values concerning hospitality, friendship, and covenant loyalty, any of his Matthew's readers encountering the story for the first time would have been horrified by the narration of this betrayal. Judas appears as the most contemptible of traitors. Jesus appears as one unjustly betrayed. I mean, it's just getting worse as we go through this thing. Okay. Proverbs 27 says, "Profuse are the kisses of an enemy." In other words, when somebody's kissing you a whole lot, that's a bad sign. In these kind of contexts, kyrē, the Greek equivalent of shalom, peace. The greeting, like the kiss, is insincere and so ironic. Judas does not wish Jesus well. Because that's when you greet somebody with shalom, you were wishing them peace. And kyrē, which is the Greek word that's translation of shalom, you were wishing Jesus well when you said hail or greeting. But Judas does not really wish Jesus well. He is rather like those who mocked Jesus in 27:29, and also like Joab, who in 2 Samuel kisses Amasa and then kills him. In 26:27-56, the 12 are utter failures. One of them betrays Jesus. Another vainly takes up sword to return evil for evil. And all finally forsake Jesus and flee. These events augment Jesus' suffering, for not only is he forsaken and left alone, but his teaching seems without effect. Betrayal, violence, and cowardice characterize those who have paid him the most heed. And yet, this failure is not the last fact, but rather the introduction to the story of the resurrection, where reconciliation is made with the disciples. So the discouragement that must have been to Jesus to see this, and he knew it ahead of time. He told Peter, made that claim, said, "I will go to the death for you." And you can see Jesus pausing to think whether he should tell Peter that he's about to betray him three times. And you can see him wrestle because do I discourage, Peter with this, or do I let him discover it himself, or do I want to sober him up now so he's ready for this when he sees into his own heart? And see, as you get better and better, you realize you're worse and worse. When you see things clear, you see what's inside. You know what you're capable of. The Apostle Paul, when we trace his histories, in one of the places he says, in his early letters, he says, "I am least of all the apostles." And then a couple of years later, when he's writing, he calls himself the least of all saints, of all believers. And then the last thing he writes, he says, "I am the chief of sinners." And he seems to be getting worse, but he's really just getting better. He's getting better. He sees clearly that in his own life there's a Judas. You know, that at every moment that wants to, or a Peter that misses and wants to be zealous or something of that type, and he gets it, right? Okay, so that's the arrest. They're now going to lead him back over here into the trials. And there are a number of trials, all of which generally, well, the first three or four are totally illegal. Jewish trials are not supposed to happen at night. That's illegal. It's supposed to be with a full complement of people. And that didn't occur. Okay. So we're on page 30. And trials, the cross, and burial. The trials that the high priest and the Jewish leaders. So first the Jews are going to try him. And then they're going to turn him over to the Roman courts. So they're going to go through their stuff. And those who took Jesus into custody
led him away to Caiaphas the high priest. Remember, they made a stop at Anna's house first, where the scribes and elders had gathered together. And Peter followed him from a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and having entered it, he was sitting with the servants to see the outcome. Now remember, everybody fled away from the arrest, but undoubtedly some of the disciples just fled far enough away to get out of danger, but then they would see all the torches and the lanterns coming, you know, going away, and they would have followed. And Peter followed this crowd. He comes to the courtyard of the high priest. Remember, we talked about the courtyard in the middle of the building, to see the outcome. And he was sitting with the servants. Now the chief priest and the whole Sanhedrin, that official religious group, were seeking false testimony against Jesus so they might have an excuse to put him to death. And they did not find any evidence that they could use among the many false witnesses who came forward. But eventually two came forward and said, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and after 3 days to build it again.'" Let me stop. Jewish law said for capital offenses you had to have a minimum of two witnesses, two eyewitnesses. It couldn't be anything like we have in the Western world where you figure it out that it had to be this person. Motive, means, method, you know, all that kind of stuff. It had to be literally eyewitnesses. And there had to be two or three. No one could be put to death on the testimony of one. And so, Jewish thing is that you would interview the witnesses separately in isolation so that somebody couldn't hear what the thing was and then just repeat it. And so they didn't get any agreement among all these people until they finally got to that quoted Jesus successfully here about destroy the temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. But he was talking about the temple of his body, remember? And the high priest rose and said to him, "Have you nothing to answer to what these men accuse you of?" Jesus is silent the whole time. But Jesus was silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." Jesus answered, said to him, "You have said the truth. I furthermore tell you, in the future, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming upon the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his garments, which is normally a sign of mourning or special evil, ripped his robe, saying, "He has blasphemed. Why do we need witnesses? Look, you have now heard the blasphemy." In other words, all the people there have heard this, so they're all witnesses. "What is your opinion?" And they answered and said, "He is guilty and should die." Then they spit in his face and struck him, and they slapped him, saying, "Prophesy to us, Messiah. Who is it that has hit you?" What this passage doesn't tell us, I think it's Luke or John, tells us that they put a blindfold on him and they hit him. So he couldn't see who it was that hit him. And this one says, "Prophesy to us, who was it that hit you?" But that detail is missing because this person knows that they're writing to people, they already know that from the other Gospels. So they blindfold him, hit him and said, "If you're, you know, prophesy to us because you're this special." And these would be like the soldiers that are doing this, you know, the temple servants and things of his time. Okay. Matthew says nothing about how grievous the charge may have been regarded, but the fact that this testimony was allowed after much else had been refused suggests that the prosecutors believed it would be useful. To speak of destroying the temple or even the temple being destroyed would definitely have been regarded as an extremely serious, indeed treasonous, offense, one deserving of capital punishment. In the book of Acts, they have another character in Christian history where the same thing happens. And they stirred up the people, the Jews in Jerusalem, the Greekish Jews, and they stirred up the people, the elders and the scribes, and they came upon him, Stephen, who was one of the first deacons, and dragged him away and brought him before the council, the Sanhedrin. And he put forward false witnesses who said, "This man incessantly speaks against this holy place, the temple,
and against the law. For we have heard him say that this Nazarene Jesus will destroy this place, that's that same statement, and alter the customs which Moses handed down to us. So they were still accusing Christians of being anti-temple, even though the Christians were meeting in the temple until we were kicked out. So, I mean, every day that they were in the temple, the apostles were there in the temple, standing on one of the little platforms, the preaching and teaching, you know, until they were finally driven out of the temple a couple of years later. Matthew's I am able, Jesus' I am able to raise, however, has the effect of shifting attention to the authority or power claimed in such a statement. In other words, saying, I will destroy this temple. He says, I am able to destroy the temple. This focuses upon the person and not the act. And it was in the personal claims of Jesus that the Jewish authorities thought their best hopes of doing away with Jesus lay. Thus the high priest's question of 63b, verse 63b. The high priest asked Jesus whether he has any response to the accusations made against him, no doubt hoping he would expose himself to further peril by what he said. So he was hoping to trap Jesus in his words again. Jesus, however, kept silent. In his trial before his Jewish authorities, as before Pilate, Jesus makes no attempt to defend himself. He never answers any of these charges. The only time he speaks is when he's actually ministering to somebody or he's actually witnessing at some level to somebody. It's really, you know, he picks his shots. When he talks to Pilate, he'll get under Pilate's skin with some talk about truth and kingdom out of this world. You'll see this, that's what he's not just going to the cross. He's going to get every good thing done that he can in his life while he's on his way. The silence of Jesus is an important motif in the Passion narrative, and perhaps allude retrospectively Isaiah 53, you know, that big thing we sing in Handel's Messiah. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that was led to slaughter, and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. So Isaiah, back, you know, some 700 years before Christ, wrote Isaiah 53. That's just this perfect statement of Christ dying for our sin. That he bore the sins of many. He was a sacrifice. It was just, the New Testament is filled with allusions to this. But there's this passage that says that, yeah, he was led to slaughter, but he didn't defend himself. He went through with it. He was like a lamb taken to slaughter that didn't try to struggle and fight. He willingly laid down his life. It was probably understood by Caiaphas, the high priest, as consent to the truthfulness of the charge brought against him. In other words, when Jesus didn't say anything, he assumed that he couldn't rebut it, see? That he couldn't defend himself. Jesus submits to the faulty reasoning of his accusers and opponents in order to accomplish the will of God and so fulfill the Scriptures. His silence was a sovereign silence. He was the one that chose the silence, and he was moving things forward. The high priest's next question is made even, are you the Son of the living God? Are you the Messiah? Is made even weightier in Mark, in Matthew, than it is in Mark by the addition solemn words, I adjure you by the living God. Now that was an oath when the high priest told you, take an oath and answer this question. You were required under the Jewish law of the day to answer that. You had to answer that question. That was just their law, not an Old Testament law, not a God's law, nothing of that type. But when you do that, that was in the council and that was sort of Jewish law at the time. And that was where Jesus first responds to these people. He charges Jesus under an oath to answer his question truthfully. The modifier, the living, in I adjure you by the living God, in reference to God, is also found in 16:16. The question is whether Jesus considers himself to be the Messiah, the Son of God. There is no need to suppose by this language that the high priest meant exactly what the early church meant by this phrase in its Christology. You know, the early church Paul and the church fathers that are not part of the New Testament, when they say Son of God, we mean we include the second person of the Trinity. We include His deity, right? So we got a lot of content in the word Son of God, whereas in the old days, Son of God may have meant just the king. So when God promised David that he would have a son, and I'll put him on the throne, and I will be his father, and he will be my son, meant that he was ruling in the place of God among, and so it just meant king with a special divine blessing upon him and a special divine involvement. The early church, we eventually got it that it meant more than that too, that it was a preeminent Son of God. He was not just a Son of God, he was the unique Son of God. That the Messiah would be the Son of God, even uniquely so, though of course metaphysically distinct from God, we're still a Trinity, was quite probably the high priest's own understanding. He might have understood it that way, that it was an exalted claim to be superhuman. For the Son of God, see these references, Jesus offers an answer to the direct question of the high priest, and it is an answer of greatest significance. Nowhere does Jesus reveal himself more than here. In other words, all the other places where he says who he is in the Gospels, it's never this clear about his power and glory. I mean, there are places, but nothing this strongly. In Matthew's account of Jesus' response, given in the historical present tense for vividness, the words, "you have said," rather than being evasive or negative, amount to an affirmative answer, like, "you have spoken truly." That was like the translation we got. "You have said it right." But in a much less direct and emphatic way that Mark reports it, "I am that." Jesus' affirmation of being the Messiah, the Son of God, the background for the two combined titles may have been Psalm 2, which we studied, may not yet in itself have been sufficient grounds for the high priest to regard him as blasphemy. See, just the claim he is the Messiah, the Son of David, the Son of God, doesn't get you in real trouble. I mean, you know, there's nothing really bad there yet. I mean, you could be that. But when Jesus adds to his answer the quoted material from Daniel 7 and the allusion to Psalm 110:2, identifying self as that triumphant figure and thus more than the Messiah as a merely human agent, when he says, "I'm going to be sitting at the throne right next to God, and you're going to see me coming in these clouds of glory," which was reserved only for God's appearance, that's a bigger claim than just claiming to be the Messiah, the earthly leader. See? And when he said that, that trips the trigger. As the one who is given dominion and glory and kingship, who all will serve and whose kingdom will see no end, the one who sits at the right hand of God, the high priest reacts to what he considers as horrifying blasphemy. It is. If it's not true, it is horrifying blasphemy. If anybody other than Jesus had said that, boy, that is hard. That really is terrible. But if it's true, if you are that figure, then you would be lying not to say it. You would be untruthful not to say it, and Jesus came to bear witness to the truth. In the face of such a startlingly claim, the high priest's reaction is understandable. I mean, if it's that bad, I mean, he's going to respond negatively. In Matthew, Jesus is neither the victim of tragic and personal circumstances nor the casualty of the ordinary machine of justice. He is rather done in by wicked people. Jesus' adversaries speak falsehoods. They accuse him of blasphemy. They condemn him to death and viciously hit and mock him. In the midst of this sinful folly, Jesus' identity becomes fully visible. He is the Son of God and Messiah, who in accordance with 2 Samuel 7:14 builds the temple. He is the King of Psalm 110, who sits at God's right hand. He is a suffering servant of Isaiah 56, whose face is spat upon.
See, all this stuff was prophesied hundreds of years before Jesus. You know, these were the marks of how we knew who he was. He fulfilled all the prophecies. If you want to know if Jesus is Messiah, you look at what the prophecies were about, and then you look at what happened to Jesus. Obviously, the passage is, like 16:13, a climactic confluence of the main Christological streams which run throughout the text. In other words, remember what we talked about, the Jewish expectations of the Messiah in the Old Testament? There were different themes. One was he was going to be a king. One, he was going to be a high priest. One, he was going to be the wisest person in the world. Once, he was going to be a suffering servant. Once, he was going to be a rejected shepherd, the 30 pieces of silver. You know, they had all these streams, and they were trying to figure out how they fit together, right? And the rabbis, we talked about how they figured out, you know, well, these two might can go together, and these might two go together. Maybe they're two messiahs, maybe they're three. But all of these things come together in the life of Jesus when he says, yep, they're all prophecy of the Messiah, but they all converge at me. He was the high priest, he was the king, he was wiser than Solomon. You know, he's the presence of God, he's greater than the temple. All of these themes of Christology about Christ, about the Messiah, converge here in this passion narrative. Why does the prophecy about the temple raise the issue of Jesus' status as Messiah and Son? The text assumes knowledge of Jewish tradition. Zechariah 6:12 predicts that the branch will build the temple of the Lord. And 2 Samuel 7, the promise to David for a dynasty, given messianic sense in both the Dead Sea Scrolls and the New Testament, foretells a royal figure who will build a house, build for God a house, and be God's son. In other words, all these same things came together, and the high priest and these folks knew it. They knew what they were looking at. Remember, he had told that parable of the wicked tenants? That this is the son, this is the heir, let's kill him and take the vineyard. They knew who this was. They saw it. Everything came together, and they saw this. Next paragraph. During Jesus' day, did the Jerusalem Sanhedrin have the authority to carry out a death sentence? A negative answer may be presupposed by the synoptics, for after the Sanhedrin finds Jesus worthy of death, it passes him on to Pilate. See, if they could kill him, guess what? He'd have died right there on the spot. But they didn't have the authority to do that, and they could get in trouble if they took the law in their own hands. So they now have got to go to the Romans and get an official death verdict. John 18 is also consistent with Josephus, that Jewish historian. After being chastised, okay, Sanhedrin 40, we can skip the rest of it because that's all about them having the authority to kill anybody. And that's going to happen. They're going to come to Pilate, and Pilate's going to say to them, judge him according to his law. He doesn't want to get in trouble with Passover. He doesn't want to get involved in this uprising. And they say, we can't kill him, is what they end up saying to him. The crowd, the Jewish people, says, we have a law that he must die, but we can't kill him, so that's why we have to bring him to you. See, that was what forced the Roman hand in this matter. Okay. And the priest, this is a quote from the Old Testament, where they're setting up the law. Moses is setting up the law. And the high priest, the priest who is highest among his brothers, on whose head the anointing oil has been poured, and has been consecrated to wear the holy garments, shall not uncover his head nor tear his clothes. Not supposed to do what he did. I mean, the Jewish high priest is supposed to do that. Everything's wrong about this. Just, they're not supposed to have trials at night. They're supposed to have everybody there. If it's a capital offense, too many things going wrong here just to show how bad things are. There are interesting parallels to our text. After the humiliated Job in Testament of Job, that's an Old Testament, not in the Old Testament, that's an extra book that they didn't put in the Bible. It's just written much, much later. Job declares that his throne is in the upper world. Elihu, in the book of Job, accuses him of speaking out in boastful grandeur of his imaginary estate. In other words, to claim that you had a throne up in heaven.
was a claim of arrogance. See? You're not supposed to do that. And so that claim was met with arrogance. In the Babylonian Talmud, Jewish literature written after this time, Metatron, who is one of the head angels, one of the big archangels in Jewish thought, Metatron is punished because he has sat in heaven and given rise to the opinion that there might be two divinities. See, there's a Jewish trend of thought that comes up after the gospel, where before this, they have Metatron as this famous angel, and he's the angel of the Lord. And so they exalted this Metatron character up to be almost close to God, you know, because he spoke for God, he was God's presence everywhere he went. But after we now have an incarnate God, see, who said that he was going to be in the throne, now they can't let an angel ever get that big because it agrees too much with Christians. That there could be somebody up high there with God. And so now they have to declare those heretics that go through this Metatron character and say that there are two thrones in heaven. So in the Jewish religious literature, they say it's a heretic that somebody says there's two thrones, even though the book of Daniel explicitly says there are two thrones. Right? But you see that's a reaction to Christian evangelism and when any time they say Jesus can't be the Son of God co-equal with God, they say, well, look, it says right here in Daniel, he's sitting on a throne there next to him. You know, so how do you answer that? And they say, well, we don't. So get out. There was no real supply of that. They had to come up with this thing here. Metatron is punished because he is set in heaven and given rise to the opinion that there might be two divinities. Akiba's interpretation of Daniel 7, where there are two thrones in heaven, one for God and one for David, is rebuked as a profaning of the Shekinah glory. In other words, it says explicitly that the son of David's got a throne up there next. And Akiba, who is one of the famous rabbis of the day, one of the Jewish figures, said that just pointed out that passage, and they condemned him as a heretic. See, they're caught. You don't know what to do with that. You're stuck. You can't deny the Scripture, but you can't allow any interpretation that favors a Messiah, an exalted Messianic figure, to occur. Next period. The full Sanhedrin normally met in their special meeting hall in the temple, the chamber of hewn stone. Now, normally when they would have a trial, you didn't have it off-site at the priest, you know, private retreat area. You had it in the temple where it was all legal and everything was supposed to be there. The temple is closed at night. Yeah, I mean, you're not supposed to be in there. You know, there's only certain activities going on there, and it's just not generally open. And especially at this particular time, this is now the night before Passover. You know, it's a busy season. They may still be doing some stuff in the courtyards as they're doing the Passover lamb, but they're not normally supposed to do that. But this kind of Sanhedrin meeting was supposed to happen in the temple anyway. In this case, many members of the Sanhedrin held a secret night meeting without advance notice in the high priest's home. Though they were investigating what they will claim is a capital offense, which you can't do it that way. At least according to later Pharisaic legal ideals, such a meeting was illegal on all of these counts. Capital trials had to meet during the day, and only after a day had intervened might the court render a verdict. So they're supposed to wait a day and deliberate. The jury is supposed to deliberate for a whole day to think through these things before they deliver a verdict. Pharisaic laws forbade executions at feast. And they're right in the middle of a feast there, Passover and unleavened bread, except for the most heinous of crimes. But the priestly aristocracy would pay little attention to what the Pharisees want. Remember, the Pharisees are just those lay teachers, those lay leaders. They don't have any money or power, you know, and they'll do what they want to. And they had to hurry before Jesus' popularity with the crowds forced his release or made him even more of a hero. See? He might end up being this martyr, and all the Galileans get upset, and there's a big revolt. You know,
So they got to move fast here, so that's why they do it illegally. Jesus' statement here is a claim to be not only the mortal Messiah, but the cosmic ruler of Daniel. Big claim. The embodiment of Israel's call, the one who would come in glory and reign forever. The phrase "from now on" is especially offensive because he thereby claims his role in the present, that he's that now, which would imply that he is their judge rather than they being his judges. Power was one Jewish title for God. It was the right hand of power. So when he makes that claim in phrase, he says, "I'm actually basically your judge here from now on. This is not you judging me. This is me." Okay. The chief literary feature of 26 is its irony. The authorities pass judgment on the one who will someday pass judgment on them. Thus, by seeking false witnesses, and the high priest, by rending his robe, disobey Moses, whereas Jesus, by refusing an oath, lives by his messianic Torah, the law. He lives by the law of the Messiah. The authorities mock Jesus' claim to be the Davidic Messiah, the fulfillment of Old Testament hopes, while their very actions bring to pass in Jesus prophecies about Isaiah's suffering servant. They're unwitting tools here. In their anger and their rage, they're not going to get the better of God's plan to save them in some cases. They accuse Jesus of blasphemy, but it is they who blaspheme the Son of God. Lastly, those who accuse Jesus of saying that he will destroy the temple of God and in 3 days build another themselves help fulfill that prophecy. For by handing him over to Pilate, they are creating the circumstance that makes it possible for the temple of his body to be raised in 3 days. So the Sanhedrin has everything backwards. All it does is ironic, and it ignorantly acts against its own true interest. This is crystal clear to the reader. It will not, however, be evidence to Jesus' persecutors until he returns. And then they'll see, oh, wow. Heavy stuff. All right, so we have the trial there. They go through this. They say he's worthy of death. So now we got to go get somebody that will agree to kill him. So now they're going to take him across the city over to where, over this section of town where Pilate is probably located. There are a couple of alternate places there. We'll look at the first part of next week at actually the steps of Jesus. And you can look at those on the maps there of where they walk. But they now would have taken him with this little mob and crowd across the city at night, okay, over and woken up. It's early the next morning, actually. This is probably taking place all night. They're still, you know, abusing him and things of that type. So now they've got to take him the next morning over to Pilate. In early trials. Pilate, there's two trials of Pilate. There's the trial of Pilate, and then Pilate sends him over to Herod. He finds out that he's from Galilee in the first trial. And Galilee is under Herod's jurisdiction, and Herod's in the city for the feast. And so he thinks, well, I'll get out of this by passing the buck. I'll send him over to Herod, let Herod deal with all this problem. Herod is going to send him back, and so there are two trials of Pilate. Okay? And early in the morning, the chief priest with the elders and scribes and the whole... Now, Jesus would have been in prison this night. He would have been jailed after all the beatings and after this whole trial. He would have been in there just going through this, enduring this until the next morning. The whole council immediately held a consultation, and tying Jesus up, binding him, they led him away and delivered him up to Pilate. That's Mark. And Luke says... And they began to accuse him in front of Pilate. We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding him to pay taxes to Caesar. Now, remember the story. He said nothing of the sort. He said, give to Caesar things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God. But
they're going to misquote him and saying he himself is Christ, the king. And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "It is as you say. You have spoken the truth." And Pilate said to the chief priests and the multitudes, "I find no guilt in this man." But they kept on insisting, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place." But when Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. See, he's out there. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was in Jerusalem at that time. Okay, and then John's account, next page. They led Jesus, therefore, from Caiaphas into the Praetorium, which is the place of judgment, the Romans. And it was early. And they themselves did not enter into the Roman thing in order that they might not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. In other words, they couldn't go into Gentile territory that was blessed under Roman gods. They would be defiled, they'd be unclean and couldn't eat the Passover. Pilate therefore went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." Pilate therefore said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." That the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Now Jesus kept talking about, when he would talk about his death, he would say, "The Son of Man will be lifted up to death," as opposed to being stoned. The Jewish executions were by stoning, not lifting up. Crucifixions were you get lifted up on a cross. Not high like they show in the movies. And we'll talk about crucifixion at some point, but it normally was eye level. There was already a stake in the ground or a tree, and when you carried just the crossbar. Unlike the movies, you know, where you got the full cross, you carried the crossbar because the thing was already in the ground. They had secured that, and a lot of times it normally was by a road, right by a local path, a main tour of the city, so you could see and grow in your fear of Rome. So everybody coming in the city would see all the people being crucified. Eye level. They would see a lot of times eye level the pain and, you know, what you got if you were a troublemaker. At this vivid, gory, violent object lesson. So, but lifted up is still, instead of being, you know, stoning, you got thrown over a cliff. See, basically stoning, where you got thrown over a cliff, and then everybody dropped the individual stones, and then they rolled the big one on you. That's the way stoning occurred. It wasn't like generally in the movies. I mean, you would do that for rhetorical, where you just throw it level. But an official stoning execution, you got thrown off of a hill of some type that was, you know, a precipice, and then stones were dropped on you. And that's the way you died in a normal stoning. But this was to show what death he was about to die. Pilate therefore entered again into the praetorium, and some of Jesus said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own, or did others tell you about me?" Now see, here's Jesus asking Pilate what he thinks of him. See, this is, you know, I mean, he's stopping here to ask, "Where do you stand?" Right in the middle of his crucifixion, he's stopping and confronting, just like he does, quietly. It's not abusive. You know, not "you brood of vipers," or "you horrible, scummy Roman." You know, it's just, "What do you think?" And you're saying this, and Pilate said, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priest delivered you up to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting, that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Pilate therefore said to him, "So you are a king." Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" Pragmatic Roman. And when he had said this, he went out to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in this guy. There's nothing wrong with this person." Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and rulers, and this is Luke's account, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning the things which you accuse him of. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him." That should be, he sent him back to us. "And indeed, nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him, for it was necessary for him to release one of them at the feast." And they all cried at once, "Away with this man and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder." Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called him out, but they shouted, "Crucify him, crucify him." Then he said the third time, "Why? What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. And the voices of these men and of the chief priest prevailed. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested, and he released to them the one they had requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison, Barabbas. But he delivered Jesus to their will. He tried three times to release him. See, I mean, he's not supposed... I mean, as bad as he was, Roman law was so strong, you didn't abuse it. If you're not supposed to put somebody to death, you're not supposed to... Roman law is the foundation of our law. Of Greek world, of Western civilization is based on the Roman law code. Of fairness, trial by jury, you know, all these things are... it was generally a good law. And he's trying not to, you know, just give in to these people. That could be that part of it was he didn't like, you know, he didn't like them. He's maybe trying to frustrate them too, but he's got a good excuse in this case. The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate, this is the second trial, when Pilate heard that saying, he was more afraid and went again into the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" See, something big, because the emperor Augustus, Caesar Augustus, was the son of God. His father, Julius Caesar, okay, was proclaimed to be a god after he passed away. He was claimed to be a god, and Augustus had coins minted that had on one side Julius Caesar, God, and on the other side it had Augustus, him, son of Caesar. And you'd make the connection there, you know, son of God, you know. And so when he hears this, when Pilate hears this, he says, "Okay, I better look a little deeper into this." Because his wife had already told him, have nothing to do. She had had a horrible dream the night before and had nothing to do with that righteous man. He is the downfall of us. Okay? So he was already spooked here. He knew what was going, you know. And so when they say he made himself the son of God, therefore he was more afraid. He went again into the praetorium and said, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer to that one. Then Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have the power to crucify you and the power to release you? You know, why aren't you working with me here to avoid crucifixion?" Jesus answered, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered to me to you has the greater sin." He's still telling Pilate that he's not the worst one in the crowd. You know, I mean, it's still wrong. But he's not the worst. He's still ministering to Pilate. He's still speaking to his heart there about this. And he says, "You don't worry about it. You go through with it because you would have no power unless it was literally given to you for this hour and for this. So go through with it, basically." From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." Well, that's the thing that ended. Because they're going to send a note, certified mail, to Caesar that said, Pilate let a king, a messianic figure, go free. You know this is not good. He's not any of your friends. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat in a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the preparation day of the Passover, about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." But they cried out, "Away from him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Which is a horrible thing for a Jew to say. We have no king but this Roman emperor that we hate. And he's no king. And you can see some of the anti-Semitism of Pilate kept talking about Jesus king, just rubbing it in. Because he probably believes he is. You know. Now the commentators will do some interesting things here and explain why Pilate didn't see any danger and when he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." So the visit to Pilate would be early in the morning because Roman officials met the public only from sunrise to noon. They had office hours only in the morning. Pilate apparently understands Jesus' claim in a religious rather than... Oh, it's 8:45. Okay, well, I guess we're going to... Because I think this... Yeah, this is too long. It's great stuff, folks. We'll have to do it next week. Okay, yeah, I'll make one comment about that. That he's going to interpret Jesus as basically a religious teacher and a philosopher that talks about kingdoms of truth, you know, kingdoms of goodness, and not anything militarily, and there's no danger. He might even see Jesus as just a crackpot, you know, just a professor type that's on some binge or something, you know. And there's no danger in that, and certainly not a capital offense, you know. And he'll wonder why everybody's so upset about it, but he knows it's because of envy. It says very specifically, he knew that the high priest that delivered him over because of envy. And that's probably why he was rubbing their nose, "Here's your king," and, you know, "King of the Jews," and probably still trying to be negative about it, as he goes. So, we'll resume here, in our last session, which is next time. And see how far we get. We have a remote possibility of getting through. it's remote. But somebody came to the think tank and wanted me to summarize a 250-page thing, you know, article I'd written. And he said, "Can you make like a four-paragraph summary? I know this is difficult," but he says, "but with God, all things are possible." Wait a minute. Whoa. Okay. I got to write him back and say, "I don't think God would participate in such a project at the 7th All right, let's go to the word of prayer. Father, we could never thank you enough for sending your Son, allowing your Son to go through this because of your love for us. We know that you exalted him after that because of that love that he had for you, in obedience to you, and in love that he had for us. We also want to thank you for the forgiveness of sins. We want to thank you for the big bath and the quietness and confidence that gives us in our relationship with you, that no matter where our paths take us or how far away we get at times, that there's always the need only for the little bath, for the little cleansing, just making up with you and being honest about our faults. We can never thank you enough for that freedom and confidence that we have about our future with that. But we understand how dear that cost the person of your Son, the agony in the garden. And I do pray that you'd give us insight as in this Easter season that we would see things
the messages and the sermons and reflect upon these things as we go forward to honor your Son more for that amazing, amazing gift. Bless these precious hearts tonight, Father, their eagerness and their openness and their interest in these matters. And bless them for every thought that they have and every time that they spend on this and their hearts for this. And bring us back safely together again next week. Grow in us the same kind of love and service of heart. Help us see your heart, the heart of the foot washer, that we might be more like that to the people in our lives as well. For your Son's sake, we pray. Amen.